hierarchy of big central systems that I could do 10 times the work with a machine that went 10 times slower than the ones I've been accustomed to. And that's about the way it is. The 4051 is certainly a satisfactory machine. And the first half of the film that I'm working on now was done there with the 4051. Yes, Ted. They are speeding up on a sine curve, and then they slow down. I've got that part of the sine curve. And indeed, they are only moving in X direction.
Which is redefined when you have a pentagonal split.
Yeah, that's in that case. That arrangement there is the liberties that I can take with my own optical printing capability. After I generated the original material that you have been seeing, I subsequently...
We spent a lot of time interacting with various computer programs and games. Sometimes the local sheriff comes around to check out who's available for a posse. This is a simulated racetrack, and you can see here these guys are trying to beat the machine around the course. For older students, for older children, we offer a course in programming, both in Pilot, which is a language originally designed for teaching, for developing computer-assisted dialogues or computerized dialogues. We found that students can write Pilot programs such that they can teach their friends to do things. We also teach programming in BASIC, and that's what we have here. Programming, as you well know, is an intellectual exercise, and only the last part of it gets to the terminal. We spend a lot of time thinking about our programs and eventually debugging our code. For students who enroll in our classes, we have some special computerized equipment, such as our graphic scope. These children are watching a game, or the John Conway's Game of Life, watching the little beasties grow and die, simulation. Something weird happened. Or did it? Also, a graphics plotter connected through a teletype allows us to draw pictures with the machine. This is one of the most powerful uses of computers in our environment. Setting things up. A little program that makes string designs. And we offer courses for adults. This particular group happens to be a PTA from a local school district who wanted to install a computer in their math lab, and the parents were going to staff the lab on the weekends, and they wanted to know how to work the equipment and something about computers so they could at least keep up with their kids. We take the adults very much through the same program that we would use with the 8 to 10 year old children, just on a little bit higher level of talk. And you can see even the adults really get into it when it comes to zapping that other spaceship in Space War. And about what our computer looks like, well, it has a teletype. And in fact, we have two computers, and they're both connected to central processing units, which the kids like to call the boss. The central processing unit is then connected to a low-speed disk, one revolution per year, and a high-speed random access memory over there in the far corner. We also have a floating-point arithmetic logic unit on the right side. Now our computer's ready for business. This is the actual machine. It's a pair of machines. They're Data General Nova 800 mini computers, actually, in this case. Each of these machines, also with disk, are capable of supporting up to 50 to 55 users. So we have a total capacity of something like 100 users on our combined system. That little sign up there says, "I'm a member of the Immortality Club." I never get sick, but sometimes you all know computers do get sick. The children always want to know something about where the machine is located and how everything's put together. It's quite obviously wired together. And in our case, the wires go a couple of different places. In one case, they go into the walls. and come out in some of our terminal rooms. And we make this very clear to the children that those little things there are not computers. Someday, obviously, computers right now, in fact, are that small, but those are teletypes, period. And the rest of the wires go into some automatic telephone answering equipment, which goes out over the telephone company's phone lines, some leased lines, through acoustical couplers to various installations around the Bay Area, all educational institutions from elementary to school to colleges, even some on the Berkeley campus here. And this particular installation is in a Montessori school in San Francisco here. And I'll end here with this shot from the Montessori school of the young teaching the younger, and turn this over to Lee to tell you a little bit about what some of these people do with our computing.
Whoops. I guess I better give you the clip.
Wires.
Hi, my name is Lee Berman. I'm our liaison person and coordinator with programs for outside users, that is schools and research organizations and people at home. I guess I'll begin the less coherent section of the presentation. You have to forgive me if there's a visionary or dreamlike quality to what I have to say about the things we do, because I had a terrible nightmare last night. I felt, since this was a sharing activity, that I should share it with you. It was about 1 o'clock in the morning, and I could distinctly see a small Federation shuttlecraft manned by Captain Kirk and Sulu moving in outer space toward a large, menacing body of some kind. The shuttlecraft was powered by an 8080-based microprocessor. As the large object, menacing object, approached, it became apparent that it was characterized by octagonal shapes, and its behavior was irregular and somewhat unpredictable. Just at the point of confrontation and interplanetary war, it became apparent to Kirk through his sensor devices and the readout he was receiving on the 8080, that the object was actually shaped like a large science center in Berkeley, that it had an incoherent collection of all sorts of computers driving it from the inside, which somewhat explained its changeable behavior, and most important of all, that it was being piloted by a sixth grader. Coleridge maintained stoutly until the day of his death that he completely wrote the poem Kubla Khan after he awoke from a nightmare, a visionary nightmare, and scribbled every word of it down just as it had occurred in his vision. Well, at 1 o'clock in the morning, after having this nightmare, I started scribbling with my Pentel. So this is why I've warned you about the perhaps uncomfortably visionary character of what I'm about to say. Well, I'm obviously addressing myself to the way that a place like the Lawrence Hall jives with the concept of personal computing. As I see it, and I think as we see it, the Lawrence Hall's purpose is to make computing power available to people on a broad base through a great variety of means, and to promote the asking thereby of pertinent questions. And I think the first and last question that we're interested in inviting people or enabling people or encouraging people to ask, that first and last question is, what are computers for, really? We get answers back through channels of communication, which range from telephone lines that feed creativity back from our schools to our system library and our machine through phone calls, frustrated, elated, or otherwise. And answers fall into somewhat predictable categories. Computers are for getting jobs done, for accomplishing purposes, for averaging letter grades, keeping track of who's at a school, for doing accounting programs, for writing something you need to get written. Even broader than that, computers are for the provision of competitive literacy. It's surprisingly common to talk to an administrator or a teacher and hear time and again how important it is, since computers are the wave of the future and since kids will be experiencing computers in college, how important it is to provide them an opportunity to use them and have access to them as tools at an early age. So competitive computer literacy is one kind of answer we get back. Then another obvious one is the computer is a tool for educational purposes. It operates in the broadest sense in the computer-assisted instruction mode. It helps teach sociology. It can contain lessons and interactively exchange them with a pupil. It can be used for language arts. But one of the answers, which is less obvious, is one of the ones that's most interesting to me. I also hear over and over again that a computer is a medium for personal growth, personal exploration. So what does that mean? What then is personal computing? As I see it, it's computing which comes from the roots up, not the other way around. It's computing that comes from the imaginative connection at the terminal back to the system. It's the antithesis of the PG&E bill, which figures so prominently in media advertising or in mysticism about computers. It's computers that come from human interaction with computers and direct or gauge the formation of the system by the needs of the people using it. So a first stage in reacting to this kind of, let's call it a needs assessment, is to provide computer contact conveniently and as cheaply as possible. And it's our first goal. We do it in a variety of ways, from providing free access in a museum-like setting, such as the one you saw in the slides, in those display terminals, to $1.50 an hour public access in our public rooms, through a program by which we offer segments of ports to users at home for personal and home recreation and education, through formal 24-hour monthly access for schools around the Bay Area.
It's a complex and it's an involved question. It has to do with the nature of art, in a sense. I don't want to get pompous about it, but the problems are, take, for example, look at the situation of Beethoven. Beethoven probably was 6 years old, was starting to hammer on a piano. He probably was playing very well by age six. He was training a mind, hand, ear relationship and developing a kind of skill which paid off for him. By the time he was in his teens, he was a European novelty of great value. He was in the courts, he was entertaining. He was a very important improviser. He was able to play all evening with pure improvisation, and he had a famous reputation. He could have died happy just with the success of his art of improvisation. And yet, on the contrary, that same man devoted himself to the most unbelievably agonizing reworking of the compositions that we know of from him today. In other words, what's involved, there's a direct need for true interactive man-machine communication and training, which is what you get as a child learning to perform with any of the musical instruments. But then finally, the art of composing music that really has validity and really sticks on your mind is a matter of the most contemplative and agonizing study and often a very, very complex work and creation. No, it doesn't have to be painful at all, and it is usually not in the least. I don't want to stress that. But I don't want to belittle the rigors of it. Okay, let's run the film.
Oh, how about the light?
Wait for the lights!
We're coming.
Turn the sound up. Sound. I think maybe we'd better back up and get the sound on. I'm sorry, I should have warned you.
Thank you.
Thank you. That's all the lesson. It's like lesson's over.
Thank you.
John and Frederick, would you folks consider entertaining some questions for a couple of minutes? Okay. Why don't both of you come up and do a duet? And possibly we can run for about 10 minutes or so and then break out. So John and Frederick, why don't you come on up?
I don't have an answer. I have a question. Where can I get one?
Be nice. I wish I could sell it at the right price. And I think we're going to get into the video disc as a medium for this kind of publication soon.
I have a question for Fred Cole. In the current Encyclopedia Britannica under Tiberius.
I promise you that when I wrote it, I mentioned Sejanus. I even mentioned the fact that after he was deposed, he was dragged to the banks of the Tiber and his hands were chopped off, because I remember it. Now, I think what happened was that volume was computer typeset. But honestly, it was in my copy. I don't know what happened.
Is it true that the people from Alpha came by bus?
It is true that they came from people Altair came by bus because they wanted to come by bark, but it was on a weekend and they couldn't do it.
Well, that's true. There are all kinds of. You get into the world of scales, and you're into a veritable nightmare of opinion and so on. All I can go by are the most rudimentary, elemental Pythagorean concepts. I seem to feel that we are drawn by these simple harmonic relationships of the, and you can't go much beyond that if you try to be analytical. And a lot of mathematicians have wanted to be, you know. Who was a Frenchman? Rameau tried and failed. Schillinger in this century tried and failed to really nail it down. I don't want to labor that. I'm just simply saying that harmonically, perceptually, we seem to arrive at, we can create anticipation, expectations, and gratify those expectations, deny them at another moment, and organize them, and that's where the composer, that's his game. It's been his game for centuries, and now it's going to be our game in a visual world. That's all I can say. Well, our ears, that gets very complicated. It's certainly true. The 19th century saw harmonics almost done in. By the time of we're into the 20th century, Arnold Schoenberg is practically ready to kick the whole thing out and start over. And 20th century composers have almost all of them rejected this out of hand. I think there is a trend now to backtrack a little bit and not be so total in our rejection. In my opinion, it's essential. We all music creates expectations and satisfy them by means of harmonic perception. Yes. Yeah. Well, I can't get into that. I suspect, much of the motivation of the 20th century composer has been a reaction against the beautiful success of the 19th century. And we're not burdened with those problems. They're their problems, not ours. That's a perennial question. I've been exploring all different kinds of relationships. I, in some cases, have composed my own music in the earliest films, and I want, once again, to be able to do that. But at the present time, I have cast about searching various cultures. I've used Indian music, and I've used this Iranian. This is a centaur, an Iranian musical instrument. And I've had people perform for me, as was the case in this film, and in earlier films, and I've used music of 19th, 17th century composers, and so a lot of jazz, too, at one time. Yeah. No, but they I don't know that there's enough in them to be worthy of publishing, but I'm in favor of being very open about this. I think this at this time, we would all be better off if we don't make other people's mistakes over again, more than what we can learn from other people.
How about Dr.
Giles? Yeah, where is he? Here. All right.
Wasn't a description of this work published in FTGS Interface a while ago?
Yeah, I started writing several different articles, and even in the proceedings for this paper, for this conference, there will be a sort of a condensed statement of these, some of these ideas.
Thanks.
I think this could go on for several hours at a minimum. Yes. John's has to take off for L.A. And are there any other questions for Mr. Poe? Yes.
Some of that junk you read was my junk, yeah. Well, the question is, why didn't science fiction 35 years ago write about lasers, computers, and what was the other thing? Navigation system. The answer is it did, it just didn't use those words. There were robots, which were, in a sense, computers. There were mechanical brains who did hard thinking other people couldn't do. The laser was described as a disintegrator ray or a death ray or a heat ray, but it worked just about like a laser does. It punched an awful lot of electrical energy into a target, severely messing up the target just as a laser does. And the guidance systems were pretty well implicit in the idea of having a spaceship that would do things by itself, you know. 35 or more years ago, Ted Sturgeon wrote a story called Killdozer about a bulldozer that did things by itself. So they did these things. We just didn't use the right terms, or else the real world didn't use the right terms. Desperate hand back there. The question is, could the flying saucers really be something from our future instead of from another planet? The general answer to any question of the form, could it be, is yes. The specific answer to this question is, I doubt the hell out of it.
Thank you very much, John Whitney and Frederick Pohl. Good night. See you tomorrow at the fair.